Governor Kemp makes plans to expand Medicaid. What conditions will he set in his proposal? GOP Congressman Rob Woodall won't run for re-election. Do Democrats now stand a real chance to win his 7th district seat? And when will Stacey Abrams declare her intentions to run for office once again? Political Rewind starts now. I'm so glad you're with us for Political Rewind today. I'm Bill Nigut. We have so much to talk about. This is one of those shows where I wish we had a buzzer and a timer so we could go through the subjects and with efficiency. But because we have so much to talk about, let's get right to our panel. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, joins us. Wednesdays and Sundays are his day in the hard edition, the newspaper edition of the paper. And you still oversee the Political Insider blog on AJC.com.
That's it.
Glad you're here, as always, Jim. Republican strategist Loretta Lepore, we've talked about her credentials a lot. She was Sonny Perdue's press secretary when he was in his first term as governor of Georgia, and was Carly Fiorina's campaign chair in Georgia, and now does a great deal of government affairs work.
Correct.
On public policy issues.
That's right. That's right. Good to be here.
Former Columbus mayor Teresa Tomlinson is back with us. And, you know, you don't have to be the mayor of Columbus to continue having a presence on Political Rewind. All you have to do is be as smart as, Teresa Tomlinson.
Or have strong opinions, either one.
You're now a partner with
Hall Booth Smith.
Okay, great. And yeah. Charles Cook, Chuck Cook, who is one of the best-known immigration attorneys in the Southeast, is back. And man, you've been in the national news this week. Just, we'll talk about it later.
A little busy.
But why have you been in the news so much?
We'll talk about that. Well, Judge 21 Savage is one of our clients, and we're seeking his release as quickly as possible.
He's become a case study in what happens when you come to this country as a young child, when you're brought here, and live here for all of those years, and suddenly are rounded up by ICE. What happens to you? And we will get to that
right
later in the show. But Jim, let's start with what is pretty big news. It's been sort of hinted at for a couple of weeks now, but Governor Kemp has now made it clear that he is going to look at waivers, number one, to make private health insurance through the Obamacare exchanges more affordable for many families. But then, even more interesting, to a certain extent, and he hasn't told us how much, to expand Medicaid to give opportunities to people who can't even afford the exchanges.
This has been since 2015. This has been a move in the making, trying to move the GOP needle on Medicaid, on drawing down more federal dollars, however you call it, drawing down more federal dollars to get more health care to people. And it's a remarkable shift. And I think you have to give credit to Democrats in the 2018 race who really put health care on the table and made very clear that it's going to be another issue in Kemp's reelection in 2022.
I think, Teresa, I'm correct in saying that we're still not quite sure, because he's now going to farm out to a consultant the specific proposal that he will send to the federal government. We're not quite sure what the expansion will look like. He didn't say anything about a full expansion to everybody who needs to be insured. That's still kind of unclear, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, first of all, they're desperately looking for some political cover. They've been on the wrong side of this issue now for almost 10 years. And his reelection would depend on this, frankly, if he wasn't to do something about it. And of course, you have 2020 coming up, and there's going to be some state legislators whose fate may be hanging in the balance, and if they have not shown some progress on this. So I think Jim's right to congratulate the Democrats. We saw State Representative B. Wynn today actually vote against the budget because of the $1 million, she would say, I'm sure, boondoggle of studying something that we all well know is desperately needed.
Let me make a slight correction here. Is, you know, I said this is done with 2022 in mind. This is going to be implemented by 2020,
yeah, exactly.
which means that this issue is very crucial to yes, U.S. Senator David Perdue as well.
Absolutely.
Let me just finish one quick thing that I think is so very important. You know, it now looks like the net difference of what this would have cost Georgia would have been $150 million, which is about $20 to $50 a year for each person that could have been covered, and that's unconscionable. And I've sat here and sung, as you know, Nathan Deal's praises about the good things he did do. This was unconscionable.
Now, let's be clear on what that 150 mm-hmm. or so million represents. That reflects what the state's share of Medicaid would be under a full expansion, which is not what we think at this point is necessarily going to happen. That does not have anything to do with the fears that Republican leaders, like the Speaker of the House, and others have said, and Nathan Deal, for that matter, have said, is the burden the state would take on if the feds at a certain point can't afford the Medicaid for all.
Well, there was a ratio where there was reimbursement or
right.
allocation from the
right.
federal government, and the concern that Governor Deal always expressed was, what happens when that runs out? Then how does the state pick up the balance?
Right.
And we've seen legislative sessions be delayed based on Medicaid funding during downturns and so forth when they had to figure out how to balance the budget. So that's a real and legitimate concern. But now what we're seeing, and we've been seeing this over time, where the pain points around health care in this state have become astronomical. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where you live in the state, whether you live in an urban area or a rural area, people are having a difficult time. Unless you're on an employer's insurance policy, it's very difficult. And so I think that they're right. The Republicans are right to take this on. I think with these Medicaid waivers, what they're trying to do is what some other states have done in seeking waivers.
Indiana,
is to be able to customize the program to suit Georgia's needs.
Right.
So we'll see how that plays out. And I'm assuming that's where they're looking for help from a consultant.
Chuck, Teresa mentioned Bea Guyon, a Democratic mm-hmm. State representative, voted against the budget because there was a $1 million line item for a consultant to come in and work on the proposal that will go to the Fed. Well, first needs legislative approval, but then go to the mm-hmm. feds. On this show, Mary Margaret Oliver, the Democratic state rep, was very skeptical about why it would cost $1 million to have a study.
It seems to make no sense to spend $1 million. Again, something we know how to fix.
Yeah.
That's already been legislatively put out there by the Democrats a number of times. Candidates have run on exactly what to do. This should take a couple of hours to do a little internet search. Maybe $1 million an hour? I don't really know what the going rate for that is right now, but I can't imagine how they're going to spend $1 million doing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they're
but
looking for some political shell game to exactly. cover is what they're looking for.
It is interesting that B. Wynn voted against this thing on the basis of that money.
Right, and that's pretty unusual. You
yeah.
didn't see votes against a budget. And this was in committee, was it not?
You know, I don't know. I just saw her tweet.
Yeah, but I'm yes, sure it would have.
I think it was in the state capitol.
And it's
yeah.
obviously in the supplemental. Mm-hmm. It's sure. not in the big budget because we haven't seen all that yet. All right. So, okay, Loretta. Mm-hmm. It's already been hinted at, but 2020 is closer than many people realize. It seems to me that Republicans have they could face some difficulties on both sides of this. On one hand, it's a great way to fight off if they pass all this, a challenge from Democrats on a very popular issue. But Brian Kemp's got to please his voters, many of whom he thought or may have supported him because he had held the line against an expansion of Medicaid, which is one of the reasons we assume he's going on this listening tour to talk to his constituents about why he's made this decision.
Well, when he campaigned, he talked about waivers.
He did talk about waivers.
He did talk
You're
about
right.
waivers.
Right.
So all along, he's been consistent in that.
Absolutely.
And I will say, just in all fairness, regarding the appropriate line item on this, Medicaid is one of the most complicated programs that the federal government and state governments run. And so when you're beginning to do something that is non-traditional, it's a complex problem, and that may be where the state is seeking assistance from people who are specialists in dealing within the Medicaid process, both at the federal level and the state level.
So let me, Jim, Loretta makes a good point. Kemp did talk about waivers during the campaign. Now, you may have heard him say some things I didn't, but principally, I think what we heard him say during the campaign was waivers that would allow the state to help people on the exchanges afford care, not a broader expansion for the underserved population.
In the spring of last year, I mean, his campaign very specifically said that they were not going to ask for one more dime of federal dollars in Medicaid funding. And that's not holding right now. That's I think that's where the shift is going to be.
All right. Well, we're going to watch this unfold.
You know, thanks to the AJC, we know that a majority of Republicans now support expanding Medicaid. And the amazing thing about Republicans is that they're people too. And so I think this is something. This is necessary. This is good policy. Frankly, the Democrats were right. I hate to, take
you
a little victory lap, but let's just admit it. It should have been done years ago. Republicans are slow to the game, but they're here now.
And but let's also remember that Brian Kemp owes a great deal to rural Georgia. The best thing that can be done for rural Georgia right now is to stabilize the health care system there.
Yeah, you reopen those hospitals. I mean, he's got to do something there. What I found really curious is it's no longer referred to as Obamacare.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now it's back to being the ACA.
It's ACA.
Again. And I just, it's the changing the words. I think it's a wonderful thing. Mm. I mean, if you can make healthcare no longer an issue because we're dealing with it, we can maybe get some of the other big issues in America and get those resolved.
Yeah, the state chamber is pushing this, and they were pushing it.
And they were pushing it years ago.
They wanted something done about it because it's an economic development issue. It's a prosperity issue.
All right. Well, we'll watch it unfold. It's a big news story, obviously, today. There's another big news story, Jim. Rob Woodall fought I don't know if he fought a hard battle because he's never been eager to be a campaigner, doesn't like to raise money. Nevertheless, he had quite a challenge from Carolyn Bordeaux in the 7th District congressional race up there. She came pretty close. She raised a lot more money than he did. And we have just learned in the last day that Rob Woodall has decided this will be his last term, last of five terms, I think.
Right. His race was the Republican victory that was won by the smallest margin in the United States.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So he was kind of a marked man. And, you know, I mean, it was all through last year. It was very interesting to see the distinction between how he ran and how Karen Handel ran. I mean, she ran a full-throated campaign. He tried to keep as low a profile as possible.
Yeah, well, your colleague Tamar Hallerman, the Washington reporter for the AJC, Loretta, Tamar said that about Woodall, that he's never really had the appetite for, she didn't use these words, but he doesn't seem to really like raising money, he likes policy. He's a policy wonk, which may be one of the reasons he's finally decided to get out of the game at a time when that district will be in more flux than ever before.
Right. Some of it had to do with his path also to that seat and being a chief of staff, having been...
He worked for John Linder, his predecessor.
So he was in Washington, and then when John Linder retired, he stepped up to run for that seat. So there was kind of a built-in support mechanism for him in that district. And Rob Woodall has always been well-liked, amazingly well-liked among Republicans. There's a lot of sadness that he's decided to step down, but certainly people understand his reasoning for why he's doing so.
Yeah, Tamar pointed out, Teresa, that he's always had a sunny disposition about Congress. I love that idea.
Yeah, right. Well, I would tell you this is great news for Democrats. That's going to make that a very competitive seat. I already received my first invitation to contribute to the Carolyn Bordeaux campaign here. I also know it looks like it's going to be a contested primary, actually. Of course, Carolyn did a fantastic job, but a young woman named Nabila Islam, who actually is quite a prolific fundraiser and has worked for the DNC and others and can put together some money, is looking at running a progressive. So that may be a scoop to you, Jim. You may want to do a little Google So that's going to bring out young folks. You're going to have women coming out. It's going to be a heck of a race, and that's great news statewide for Democrats.
And clearly, there are any number of Republicans who are going to line up for a shot at this, aren't there?
Well, I will tell you what. You've got former Representative Scott Hilton. You've got current State Senator Renee Unterman, who is on the outs with her party.
Yep.
And I think in the 6th and the 7th district this year, you're going to see a lot of Republicans catch up or out fever. You know, whether it's time for them to take the gamble on running for higher office or be voted out in the next wave.
Yeah.
But before we move on, I think we need to appreciate just having a congressman who didn't like to raise money.
How refreshing
all right.
is that?
Yeah, so let's, okay. Galloway makes a good point. But there are times when people make criticisms of the media that I think are appropriate. And here's one moment for that. We judged a great deal of the 7th District race on the fact that Carolyn Bordeaux was such a phenomenal fundraiser and outraising Woodall by vast sums of money. So we're sort of having it both ways when we say this now.
You know, I lived in that district for the first 10 years I lived in Georgia. And I look at that district now, 15 years later, it is completely different.
Yeah.
As far as the demographic makeup. That is going to be a very hard district in 2 years for a Republican to win.
Well, you know what?
Specifically, she or he is very charismatic.
So,
very well known.
Okay, Loretta.
Yes.
Here's the question. The 6th and the 7th both looking increasingly Democratic. How long is it going to be before the Republican-controlled legislature, and they are likely to stay in control past 2020, carves out a super district that sucks all the Democratic voters into one district, consolidating the 6 and 7, they go ahead and sacrifice one seat, but they assure themselves that they are going to carve out safe seats for Republicans in the process?
That'll be 2022.
Okay.
wait a second. Are you saying there's gerrymandering in Georgia?
I will say, be very careful about that. I think you're spot on right, but be very careful about that. There's going to be a stigma about gerrymandering. It is going to be an issue, and I think a lot of people may lose their seats just from the fear, because it's like voter suppression. I think people have a very bad taste in their mouth. It used to be part of the game, right? It's just the way the game was played.
Yeah.
That's not the case anymore. It's anti-American. It's people think of it as being anti one man, one vote. And I think it's going to become an issue. And so it could be actually a turnout mechanism for Democrats, is that if you leave these Republicans in there, they're going to gerrymander, they're going to take your vote away.
And with the population shift out of rural Georgia and into the metro region, it's going to be harder to draw those lines. I guess that's right.
You're going to run out of geography at a certain point.
We look at what happened in North Carolina. I mean, as they, the gerrymandering they did there to make it so Republican when the voter electorate was 50-50. The Supreme Court's going to look at this issue again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if more states get into this, the Supreme Court is going to rule against it.
All right.
Well, that was a point.
Go ahead. You get the last word.
There's so much more transparency into the process now than there was in the past. And then people are so much more sophisticated about redrawing district lines. So it's not going to be an easy process, and it's not as the Republicans are going to be at will to carve those districts as they so choose.
All right.
There's going to have to be some consensus building, and they're going to have to really be judicious about what those districts look like.
All right, that's the last word. You get the last word in the first segment. I'll tell you what, why don't we get a break out of the way? Because when we come back, it's been a big week, we know, for Stacey Abrams giving a response to the State of the Union message, and by the way, being the guest this week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is also a very big deal. And most people in Georgia are really interested in knowing what Stacey Abrams might plan next. But I'll bet you there's one person who's in this room right now who is more interested than any of the rest of us. We'll talk to her when we get back.
Are you thinking of getting rid of your old car, truck, or RV? GPB's vehicle donation program is here to help. Donating has never been easier. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup of your vehicle. Just go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227, and thanks so much.
My name is Chuck Reese. I'm the editor of an online magazine called The Bitter Southerner. I've seen decades of misconceptions about the South from the Beverly Hillbillies on down. But in my new podcast with GPB, we're going to challenge those stereotypes and paint a very different picture of the American South. Join me for The Bitter Southerner podcast. Details are at bittersoutherner.com.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. By now, everyone knows Stacey Abrams gave the Democratic response to the State of the Union address. She got pretty good reviews from almost everybody on the who are either journalists and in the middle somewhere, Democrats, Republicans less so. But she did give good reviews. Let's listen to just a moment of what she had to say.
Just a few weeks ago, I joined volunteers to distribute meals to furloughed federal workers. They waited in line for a box of food and a sliver of hope since they hadn't received paychecks in weeks. Making livelihoods of our federal workers a pawn for political games is a disgrace. The shutdown was a stunt engineered by the President of the United States, one that defied every tenet of fairness and abandoned not just our people, but our values. For 7 years, I led the Democratic Party in the Georgia House of Representatives. I didn't always agree with the Republican speaker or governor, but I understood that our constituents didn't care about our political parties, they cared about their lives. So when we had to negotiate criminal justice reform or transportation or foster care improvements, the leaders of our state didn't shut down. We came together and we kept our word.
So, Jim Galloway, the reason that our senior producer, Tom Faust, pulled that soundbite from her response is that he thought, and I think he was correct in this, that that particular moment came closer to giving us some hints about how Stacey Abrams might see her political future and the way in which she'd position herself, as she did during the governor's race.
Well, and what was unusual, if you live in Georgia, what was unusual about that clip was hearing her address some very specific federal issues, which, of course, leads one to think, and, well, just the very fact that she was standing there in front of that camera leads one to think that Chuck Schumer is having some impact on her career arc.
Chuck, this is a very big decision for Abrams.
She definitely, she's going to run, obviously, she said, for something. This was a unique opportunity for her to present herself to the whole country. There are some people that think maybe she's running for vice president. Mm. Mm-hmm. She would make an excellent addition to a ticket that needed balance. At the same time, she is incredibly smart and incredibly blunt. I think she has a thirst to represent this state. So, I mean, I thought when she lost, she is going to be back in 2022. But it's clear she's not waiting. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in 2020 with Senator Perdue.
You want to weigh in? Where do you think she's headed?
I don't know where she's headed. I think her remarks were quintessential Stacey Abrams. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think anybody here in Georgia was really surprised by her delivery or her ability to tell a good story or to present herself in a professional manner. You know, Chuck Schumer, too, was in a little bit of a box. He's got a lot of members of his chamber and within his caucus seeking the presidency. And so he had to go outside the context of the chamber.
Yeah, somebody said on our show the other day, as he looked around the Senate, everybody is running for president, couldn't pick one of them.
Right, and she is the most recent candidate to have the most national exposure outside of Andrew Gillum in Florida.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But she has kept much more engaged than either Beto O'Rourke or Andrew Gillum.
Absolutely. All right. Mm-hmm. So,
right. Yeah.
Teresa, you are a valued panelist on this show and have been from the first appearance. But we're at that moment where we also have to talk to you as a new subject. Mm-hmm. You've made it clear that you have some interest in running in 2020. You've now hired Joe Trippi, who was one of the real star consultants of the Democratic Party. And we could go through his credentials, but they're significant. Assuming that the Senate is something you've been looking at, after a successful tenure as mayor of Columbus, how does this put you in a little bit of a box?
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. First of all, let me correct just a few things, because let me clarify. First of all, I've not hired Joe.
Oh, okay.
I've just been working with Joe.
Gotcha.
He's very interested in this race and in a Democrat winning statewide, which, of course, there's several opportunities, at least two Senate seats, a governor's seat. But let me make this clear. Democrats are going to take those two Senate seats, and we're going to take the governor's mansion, okay? And so Stacey and I, for instance, and many others, we've been in the field for a very long time, Bill. And we intend to work together to make sure we are maximizing our opportunities. So whereas everybody has ego involved, let me just say it's ego that has been well tilled in the field of making sure that Democrats harvest these statewide seats. So I want to say that Stacey did a fantastic job. And the Senate seat is hers if she wants it. But I've got to say it by any assessment, you would think, well, of course, she's running for Senate, as Jim just said. And then again, you see some other things that would suggest that she is definitely nationally positioning herself. And I think also she sees herself as a history maker. You know, I was one of her core supporters, so I had the opportunity to attend, a closed event where it was said that her lawsuits are the new Brown versus Board of Education. And it was heavily implied, and I think it's accurate, that she's the John Lewis of this era.
These are the lawsuits challenging Georgia's voting system.
Yes, the voter suppression. Yeah. She has a national stage, and by all accounts, she's bringing in some serious money to Fair Fight Georgia. So I think that the world is her oyster. As I said earlier, she's caught lightning in a bottle. And as a constructive Democratic Party, we need to see where this moment's going to take us, right? And that's what we're all sort of waiting. And I don't know. I've spoken with her. I've not spoken with her in the last few days, certainly, to know where she's thinking. And I honestly don't know if she has made a decision. But I will say that both the Washington Post yesterday, Jennifer Rubin, and the New York Times the day before, both said she should be running for president. I do know that there's some national polling going on. And if you're running for Senate, what do you care what people in Nebraska think about you or what your popularity is in Nevada, for instance? And I'll say this final thing. Why in the world are people talking about Beto O'Rourke running for president and not Stacey Abrams? And I don't know if she's thought about this, but if she has, there's got to be just a tinge of resentment of why her name's not at the top of the list, and maybe this is what that's about. Who knows?
So, Jim, we've watched Teresa Tomlinson's career, as we have a lot of political leaders in this state, and there were a lot of people who thought that perhaps Teresa was going to run in 2018, get into that governor's race, and chose to pass it up. I don't envy the fact that you've now got to sort of wait until the end of March, which is when Abrams said she's going to tell us what she wants to do before you can pursue your own political future.
Yeah, but Teresa, to your point, I mean, if you look at this as something more than a one-off, and if you look at this as a Democratic trend, you do have to say, okay, Johnny Isaacson term, he has to run for re-election in 2022.
Yep.
We have a governor's race in 2022. Every state constitutional office comes open in 2022. So there are opportunities out there.
Yeah.
So you've done consulting.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, if Teresa wants to run for Senate, Loretta, she's already said she's all in for Abrams if Abrams runs. But the longer Stacey doesn't say anything, Teresa can't do much. She's kind of frozen.
Well,
give her some advice.
I mean, if she's getting advice from Trippi, she might as well get it from Lepore.
Look, I think Democrats, particularly in Georgia, they have historically cleared the field for a single candidate, unlike Republicans. So you can look back when Michelle Nunn,
Since they've
Carter.
Been in the minority only.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, well, since they've been in the minority.
Right.
Okay. So they have a tendency to do that. And so, to her point, they are working in tandem. And I think that is something that Republicans need to take note of, is that the Democrats are much more consolidated than Republicans right now. And that could have an effect in 2020 and 22. So there has to be a rallying cry within the Republican Party as well. I would take, two issues with Teresa's comments. One is, I think some of the excitement around Beto O'Rourke is the fact that he ran for a national office, where Stacey was running for a state-level office. If I'm correct, he actually served in Congress.
Yes,
yeah.
He did.
There seems to be some recognition that he has some national credibility already that she's now developing. I think the other thing is while Stacey Abrams clearly has a lot of talents and gifts, it's a little premature to judge her as her generation's John Lewis. I mean, I think that that's just not an equal playing field, you know, and so the proof is always in the pudding. And we'll see in subsequent years and coming years how she holds on to this so-called lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, I mean, I hear that, except I think what I heard, Chuck, and maybe it is a little overdone, but the voter suppression issues that Stacey Abrams believes need to be addressed, all of the issues about purges of voters from the voter rolls, I think you could fairly say this is a huge civil rights issue, whether it's John Lewis or not.
Not only here in Georgia, but throughout the United States. And so as that movement moves forward, it gives her more credibility as the leader of that movement. And my concern with the Democrats is something that I've always said, they could screw up a one-person parade. And Virginia is a key example of that, literally today, as we're living it. So it really depends on whether they can continue to hold together or whether infighting at the national level may destroy the opportunities at local seats or statewide seats like this.
Teresa, I want to give you the last word on this subject because, there are a lot of eyes on you and the Democratic Party right now as you decide what your future is going to be. So let me give you a chance to say a last couple words about
it. Well, I'll say it from a pundit analyst view. How about that? I do think it's important that we have non-Metro Atlanta candidates for statewide office from the Democratic Party. You know, we run so strong in those well-populated urbanized areas, but the Metro Atlanta area is 9 counties. What about the other 150? And I think Rusty Paul, my good friend, one of the last times that he and I were able to be here together, he said that he really thought that the Republicans had one more rural strategy left in them, right? Well,
yes.
not if there is a non-Metro Atlanta candidate. I truly believe you start skimming off some of those votes. And that's what's interesting. That's why I think the Joe Trippies of the world who was with Doug Jones and saw that happen.
He did help Doug Jones win that seat in Alabama.
That explains the strategy of it. That's why people are interested in this, is because the Republican strategy is one of those things. It's like going to a large dinner where you see the 999s and somehow it adds up to a figure that you cannot fathom. And until you get out your calculator, but that's what they're doing. And those margins are so small. If you come up with a way to shave those margins, the rural strategy does not work. And that's why you see the analyst and the strategist very interested in these statewide races.
Jim, any comments before we take another break?
I think you're going to see, we've already seen Brian Kemp have an outreach office in the state capitol.
Yeah.
And that's Martha Zoller, and her specialty is North Metro Atlanta suburbs. I think you're going to see David Perdue a lot in the burbs over the next 18 months.
Okay, well, we're going to watch all of that unfold. We're going to get to our final break of the show. By the way, before we do, one quick item that kind of came up this morning that we didn't have a chance to discuss before the show started. Jim, there was a very important ruling by the United States Supreme Court today on a Louisiana abortion statute, which was going to limit the state essentially to one abortion provider in the entire state. What was fascinating about it is that it was a 5-4 decision, and Chief Justice Roberts, usually thought of as quite conservative, ruled with the more liberal majority. That's really fascinating.
That's fascinating, and it means that there's going to be a whole lot of pressure on Donald Trump to find and appoint one more Supreme Court justice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, in my lawyer hat,
sure.
A lot of times these conservative, thought of conservative, but libertarian type judges, as Robert says, you see them siding with things like gay marriage. You see them being very intellectual and not as political as maybe some had hoped. And Roberts is proving to be that jurist.
One of the things that I think is going to be interesting to watch is that we know that Brian Kemp did run on a platform of passing the strongest anti-abortion statutes in the country. This court decision may be one reason you would want to be a little cautious about how you proceed with that. So we're going to have to see how this unfolds. This was not a final decision. I mean, we could still see this case still comes to the Supreme Court for a fuller review, but and as states around the country are beginning to pass more abortion restrictions, we'll see if Georgia is going to go ahead with legislation that does make it tougher.
Well, I think we'll see legislation come up. I think how far it moves will be the question, because to all the issues we've talked about just now, you know, suburban voters, female women, female voters, their significance in voting in 2020. They've made themselves very clear in the last election cycle. They're not going to support probably stronger restrictions in the metro region, in particular in the northern suburbs. So you're and we've heard Speaker Ralston speak to the fact that he's being very mindful of what happened this last election cycle in metro. So if that legislation comes out of the House, it would be pretty remarkable.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way. And then, Chuck, you're in the spotlight.
We're going to talk a little bit today.
We're talking immigration.
Immigration, shocking. It's an issue again. Who would have thought of it?
We'll be back in a minute.
I'm John Dankosky. This month, the Grand Canyon celebrates 100 years as a national park. This week on Science Friday, how people explore and understand the canyon through maps.
The tools that allow us to see the Grand Canyon in its entirety are maps themselves.
Plus, a push of a button can order us dinner, turn on the lights, and even find us a date. How has the button changed the way we interact with technology? That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 on GPB and gpbnews.org.
It's been almost a year since 17 people were killed at a high school in Parkland, Florida. Sam Zeif lost one of his best friends that day, and he's still trying to deal with the trauma.
I've always said, like, I don't need to go to a therapist because I talk to my friends, but I just still have so much, like, racing around in my mind about it.
One survivor, 1 year later, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 today on GPB and gpbnews.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. By the way, I forgot to mention when we were talking about Abrams, I did say she was a guest down in Savannah on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which taped at our bureau offices down there, not in the offices, but as partners, our Savannah bureau worked with them. And that show, if you want to listen to Abrams, who her staff tells me was more excited about being interviewed by Peter Sagal than anyone else who she has ever been interviewed by, you can listen to it on GPB radio across the state at 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. All right, Chuck, on Tuesday night, the president went in front of a joint session of Congress finally, and immigration was one of his big subjects. Here's just one of the things he said.
As we speak, large organized caravans are on the march to the United States. We have just heard that Mexican cities, in order to remove the illegal immigrants from their communities, are getting trucks and buses to bring them up to our country in areas where there is little border protection. I have ordered another 3,750 troops to our southern border to prepare for this tremendous onslaught. This is a moral issue. The lawless state of our southern border is a threat to the safety, security, and financial well-being of all America.
And the president made many more remarks about immigration, even as a conference committee of Senate and House members are trying to come to some compromise on how to get a continuing resolution passed that will include more efforts at border security without giving Trump, Democrats say, his $5.7 billion for a wall. But one quick fact check, and there were certainly plenty, and you know this, Chuck, I assume. When the president said that the Mexican government is rounding people up and dropping, in fact, I believe I'm correct in saying the Mexican government has now adopted a policy in which they are hoping to keep many of the people moving north in Mexico and help them establish themselves there. Am I right?
Well, that's absolutely true. Mexico actually has the same problem the United States has. It's a demographic problem. We will never again see millions of Mexican youth coming to the border looking for work because they don't have them, much like we don't have them. You know, with birth rates are now below replacement level in both countries. And they see in this group of people coming up, and they're not millions of people coming up. There's a few thousand coming up. They need the workers. There are millions of, thousands of open positions at the maquiladoras, which are the plants that were created after NAFTA on the border. They just don't have the bodies to fill these positions. So, yes, they're actually offering asylum. They're offering work permits after a background check. And they're not keeping everybody. And a lot of people, though, don't want to stay in Mexico. They want to come to the U.S. for different reasons. Some are jobs, some are family, and some really are the fear of what's happening to them in their home countries.
How is, and then we'll open it up to everybody, but so the president's made it clear that the issue that he probably won him the White House, or certainly came, was one of the big issues that won him the White House, is going to stay, he's going to keep it going till 2020. In a very broad and general way, how is that affecting, say, your work as an immigration lawyer, the immigrant community that is here, undocumented immigrants that are here, our work at the border? Just give us a broad picture of what it's doing.
Well, let's, best thing to point out is it's not just affecting the undocumented population. It's affecting all immigrants, because all immigrants feel as if they're under attack. I think the idea of talking about the wall and talking about immigrants in the negative way they've been talked about out of Washington, D.C. and the White House is to basically send the message, we don't want you here. We don't want you to come. And that's been evident in on the ground, people like me, to see the slowing down of applications. A great example is this. The last year of the Obama administration took 4 to 6 months to naturalize. Yesterday, they updated their data, and now it takes 18 to 36 months to naturalize. The law didn't change. Nothing changed, but everything is being slow-walked, slow-down to limit legal immigration. The big problem with the entire immigration argument we're having about the border is if they're coming for jobs, and there are jobs here, why don't we fix our legal immigration system to allow them to get those jobs if they're coming for them and they're open? The other big problem that you're seeing is a direct result of intentionally limiting the number of people who can come up to a port of entry and ask for asylum. Mm-hmm. U.S. law allows anybody in the whole world to walk up to any port of entry and say, I want asylum. And U.S. law says you can come in and you can apply for it here. But the administration is doing what's called metering. In some ports of entry, they're only allowing 20 people a day or 50 people a day into in. So instead of sending additional resources from USCIS and ICE and CBP to those ports of entry, they're simply saying, wait in Mexico. And that's what's caused people to then become desperate and say, let's walk down 30 miles. Let's go 200 miles to the middle of the desert. And what we're seeing there is they cross the border, they get over whatever fence is there, and they just sit down and wait.
So Jim, it's not only the president's reelection campaign, which is going to have which immigration is going to play a big role in. There are Georgia Republicans like David Perdue, like Republican candidates or Republican incumbents in Congress who are going to be having to stick with the president on immigration matters. We don't really know how big a winning issue this is for in Georgia right now, do we?
And it gets very, very complicated because David Perdue and Tom Cotton have been pushing this remake of who we allow. They want the U.S. to have a greater say in who we allow in based on education, on skills and such. Chuck, one question I would have is okay, let's take Donald Trump out of the equation. Mm-hmm. And if you just have the House and Senate conference committees working together this week, what is the cleanest immigration deal that they can very quickly come up with?
If Donald Trump were out of the equation, they would create a big, giant border wall security fence, spend $5 to $10 to $20 billion on it, and every DACA kid would get a green card. Everybody who's undocumented would get a work permit. They would modernize our legal immigration system, which is actually quite easy to do outside of the Perdue bill. And if that got to the president's desk and he's willing to sign it, I mean, they could do that in a week. It's easy to do.
I heard Chuck was saying, Loretta, was not whether Trump was involved or not, whether Nancy Pelosi was in it or not. If he believes they'd give the money to the wall without Trump there, then it's Pelosi who's the problem.
Well, the outline that Chuck presented seems similar, very, very close to the bipartisan legislation
that did pass. Right. Yeah, in 2007,
passed overwhelmingly.
Right.
Okay, but you talked about a wall, a giant wall.
But they did approve, what, $25 million?
Well, no, they had $65 billion
for
the wall.
All right.
In there already.
Good. Thank you. So, thank you for correcting me.
Yeah. Well, history's going to actually treat Donald Trump and, unfortunately, all of our Republican friends very poorly on this particular issue. I think Chuck touched on a couple of things. First of all, yes, this is a humanitarian issue. We've seen children ripped away from families and the things that have been pulling at our heartstrings, if somehow that doesn't move you, that we are defying our legacy as the shining city on the hill, as Reagan called us, then the fact that they're human beings and therefore also happen to be economic resources that can help build and strengthen our country. And we do have a negative replacement rate for unemployment in this country. Our birth rate is not keeping up with the demand that we need to maintain our population and be a strong economic force going forward as we would like. And so this has become an easy political tool. It is the Pandora's box of voter turnout. For some reason, Donald Trump has become addicted to it and taken the Republican.
But will it work for Republicans in elections in 2020, including here in Georgia with David Perdue on the ballot?
Right. It's hard to say. Things are changing so much, and there's going to be a tipping point of human outrage. And I think that just like we did with the health care, and now everybody's calling it ACA and no longer Obamacare, right? Democrats are going to keep pushing this issue, and at some point there's going to be a moral and economic tipping point where people are going to think this is utterly foolish. And let me just say before my good friend Loretta jumps in, you know the Republicans are so wrong on this because they cannot respond to what I said without saying Democrats want open borders. I have never heard a Democrat, never met a Democrat who's ever said anything about open borders. And so when you go to what lawyers call non sequiturs, jump to an illogical extreme, what you're telling everybody is you cannot support your position.
Loretta?
Well, I think that you do voters in this country a disservice if you assume that they don't see through Nancy Pelosi, right? So Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats voted for a bill that had wall funding in it and now are calling it immoral. There is a wall on the border currently. So there's a lot of duplicity. And to assume that the American voters don't see that duplicity, it is really selling them very short. So that's one point. I think the other point is this whole rhetoric about what was it that you said about the Republican point of view that they keep
open borders.
That it's about open borders, right? And I think that is a talking point that has become a political talking point. But it's the same. It's a counterpoint to what Democrats are saying is an immoral policy. Mm-hmm. So how do you call something that already exists, that they've already voted on, now immoral? So we have this rhetoric going on that is not productive to the process. And to say that the American people do not see through this on both sides is just not true.
Chuck?
What I find interesting about this whole debate about immigration, which is, took up, it seemed to me, half the State of the Union address, is that we're really only talking about 10% of the U.S. population at the most. And then undocumented immigrants are less than 3% of the U.S. population. And we're spending all this time.
Who are the 10? Then what are the other 7?
Those are the immigrants.
Okay.
35 million people
okay.
are not or permanent residents or citizens that are born abroad. It's a small percentage of who we are as a country. I think people are interested in this because it defines who we are. We are all immigrants in some way or another in our families. And because we're all immigrants, we tend to think that we are special from where we came from. Where if you look at it from the perspective that I have the blessing of looking at it from really inside the game is how it's played, is that our past, our ancestors, my grandparents came the same way these people are coming from Honduras today. The laws are just a little bit different today than they were. Laws can be changed. Yes, we're a nation of laws, but we frequently change our immigration laws to reflect our economic and societal needs. But because it's become so toxic with words like the wall or open borders or immorality, we're ignoring our own own self-interest in having an immigration system that works, and we're getting out self-interested by countries like Canada, which has a much less complex and a more welcoming system. Australia, which has more than 35% of their population is foreign-born. When you tell foreign students who we bring here in droves, almost a million in the last year of the Obama administration, when you graduate after you get your PhD from Tech, you need to go home. Mm-hmm. That's stupid.
Yeah.
We need to have our Congress get over this rhetoric, have the president get over his rhetoric, and just fix the problem. It's easily fixable. And most Americans are going to be happy at the end of the day when it's fixed. I want to take one more point.
You talk
about the whole voting in Georgia. How is this going to affect David Perdue? Well, Jim pointed out David Perdue produced a bill that would half the number of legal immigrants to America. It's a bad bill. And that's why it only ever got 2 co-sponsors. But think about that bill in rural Georgia. Rural Georgia depends on migrant labor. If you drive through rural Georgia, it's no longer a black and white area. There's lots of brown in rural Georgia. There's lots of Indian, maybe not American Indians, but Indians from India in rural Georgia. Yeah. There's lots of Chinese or Asians in rural Georgia. It's a different kind of place. And they now know those immigrants. And so I don't think it's a big winner for a big enough section of rural Georgia to carry Perdue over the finish line if this is what he's going to hang on to.
Yeah, everybody at this table seems to me, Jim, to say, be making a plea that we get past the rhetoric on both sides.
Well, this whole table is very much reflective of Johnny Isaacson's speech just before the shutdown was shut down, and where he said was that Republicans made a terrible misstep in 2006, 2007 when they made immigration the litmus test in GOP primaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it has shut off any kind of negotiation that's has just sent us into a tailspin.
All right, we are running out of time in the show. We got a few minutes left. We're not going to solve the immigration problem right now, but let's talk about one more aspect of it, Chuck. I mentioned at the very top of the show, you have a client now, and in fact, you're waiting for a word from ICE right now about his fate. 21 Savage, who most of it, you know, my children have both now grown and left home, so I don't hear as much about the rappers of the day as I used to. He's a very popular young rapper. He lives here, came to this country with his family when he was 5 years old, and clearly has overstayed the amount of time he was supposed to be here. But this has now become a national story. The Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, other publications saying he is an example of what's wrong with our immigration policy. Give us a couple minutes.
What's interesting about this young man, he came as a child of a legal immigrant working in the United States. That visa ended up expiring and he ended up staying. He grew up in those parts of Atlanta that a lot of us don't hang around in. He has been successfully been able to come out of it. He went through some difficult struggles as a young man. He would have been DACA eligible if he had completed high school. But he is now not just famous because his music is extraordinary, but also because he is a symbol that immigration is not a Latino issue.
Where was he born?
He was born in the UK, in London. Although you're talking to him, there's no hint of a British accent at all.
Well, he's been here since he was five.
He was a kid, right? So you would just think he's an American. And you look at that, it's now a black issue. It's an Asian issue. And this is what I think is waking up a lot of the communities that really in the past never paid attention to the immigration issue, because it really affects the black community. It affects the Asian community. And as we try to get him out, as we fight his case, you know, immigration is not mandatorily holding him. They can release him at any moment. Mm-hmm. It has become political as a result. And are you going to detain this young black man because of allegations that may have happened in his past with nothing that makes you do that?
Where is he being held?
We're not disclosing where he's being held, Jim, because we're concerned about as security as ICE is as well.
We should say, by the way, in your talking about his being held, he's up for two Grammy Awards.
He is.
The Grammys are coming right up, and he's not going to be
He's supposed
able to
be performing
there.
On Sunday at the Grammys.
Yeah.
And ICE is well aware of that, and we're hopefully quickly here, maybe right as soon as this show is over, that he's either out or he's in. And if he's in, we have go to our next level of strategy.
Don't you have a message yet on your phone?
It seems to be buzzing as we're talking.
Check. We'll let you check. We want to know. We'll get it on the air. Okay, we're taping this on Friday. Yeah, we're live on the radio Friday.
I think we're going to keep that side right now.
So
it's profoundly tragic. I mean, it really is. This young man chose us. This talented young man chose to be an American, and we're going to kick him out, right? And the other thing I think that's so fascinating about this particular case, the 21 Savage case, is that he overstayed a visa of his parents. And that is where the vast majority of quote-unquote illegal immigrants, not the ones who were, in Donald Trump's mind, storming the borders that don't exist, but it's the people who came here to be productive parts of our economy and overstayed because they want to be Americans. And they tried to make him out. I think there was a bit of cultural bias. They tried to make him out to be a criminal, but the truth is, Bill, 50% of all even illegal immigrants, all illegal immigrants are 50% less likely to commit a crime than Americans.
I'm going to give you 20 seconds because we're really out of time. But he has broken the law. I mean, it comes down to it. There should be ways to keep a kid like that here. But how do you balance what he's built for himself here against the fact that breaking he is here illegally?
Right, breaking the law by overstaying his visa.
Yeah, simply that.
That's actually not a criminal law. That is a civil violation. Right. It is not a criminal violation.
Okay.
The law he broke was desiring to be an American.
And he was a minor.
That's the law.
He was a minor when
it
that
is,
happened.
Right. So. It was not his law, and it's not criminal.
Yeah. All right, I got to stop you. We're completely out of time for today's show. I wish we could talk more about it because it's a fascinating case. But Loretta Lepore, Chuck Cook, Teresa Tomlinson, Jim Galloway, thanks for a really great discussion today. Jim, you are back with me on Monday afternoon. We'll have another show. There were so many things we didn't get to today. You and I are going to put our heads together and put them on the list for Monday's show.
All right.
And thank you all for being with us for Political Rewind. Again, we'll see you on Monday on the radio at 2 o'clock on GPB across the state. Take care.